today that it was reliable, studied with Nadia Boulanger. But then I added, if she didn't, she didn't have to. Gerald Marx wrote All of Me, and is it true what they say about Dixie? But all year round, he travels from college to college, preaching the gospel of ASCAP to students trying to elbow us out of our profession. I proved my disloyalty to Tin Pan Alley tradition in an interview at Symphony Space last month when I criticized an old-fashioned concept, the torch song. The image of a broken-hearted woman holding up a lamppost, singing about her wayward lover. He mistreats me, he cheats me, he beats me, but I forgive him because I love him. I call that type of lyric the doormat format. I think it's obvious that writers and composers are incalculably indebted to the technology that popularizes their work. Without it, their output would be known and remembered only by a privileged handful. But there is danger in that dependency. The fantastic developments, all the way from Victor to video and sound, increases the temptation for songwriters to function less with a heart and much more with an eye to the profits magnified by technology. We know that lobotomized songs have been written by computer. Are we facing a time when marketing techniques will assemble the computerized data to determine the exact elements that comprise a hit song? Will statistics supply the catchy title? Will audio tests prove the efficacy of the beat that stimulates the right sexual response? Will melody and harmony be certified for their appeal to yuppie love and puppy love? Will these computerized findings be mixed in the prescribed proportion and then substituted for human creativity? Are we heading for an era like the one in Germany after World War I, the scene of an apocryphal and familiar joke about the man who sent away for a baby carriage that could be assembled? When it arrived, he tried and tried again and again to put the parts together, but no matter how he combined them, it always turned out to be a machine gun. The human element may be de-emphasized in these troublesome times, but we must believe that if technology has come a long way, people also have come a long way, baby. Oscar Hammerstein made the point in South Pacific that you've got to be taught to hate. Now, there's a corollary to that. People hate to be taught. They're reluctant to part with outworn concepts. But I take the view that wherever possible, a song should advance not only the music business, but the quality of life. In the Tin Pan Alley days of old, a song about India could say, down in Bombay, down in Bombay, where the women dress in leaves, men walk around in BVDs, down in Bombay. They don't make them like that anymore. Thank heaven. And I think we've come a long way from this one. If every little star was a little pickaninny, and there was a little chicken in the moon, say there'd be no light, cause every night each coon would take a knife and fork and spoon, and soon there wouldn't be a dipper or a milky, milky way, and there'd be chicken, chicken morning, night and noon. If every little star was a little pickaninny, and there was a little chicken in the moon. I believe that a song reflects the mood of the times in which it first saw the light of day. If its sentiments are honest and the musical emotion is genuine, it can have meaning for different people and different times. even if its meaning can be different. I'm the sole survivor of a song that I wrote with Vincent Humans and Billy Rose 57 years ago. And I'd like to show you, or have you hear, brief excerpts of how four different singers recorded that number. And at this moment, I must ask where the equipment is to do that. There's a volume on, you know. You see what I meant about machinery? Can you guess who that was? Who said Nelson Eddy? You win the prize. Would you care to try for the next level? All right, we start it again. Can we turn the volume a little? Start it again now, please.
Start. Without a song, the day would never end. Without a song, the road would never bend. When things go wrong, a man ain't got a friend. Without a song. That field of corn would never see it plow. That field of corn would be deserted now. Man is born, but he's no good no how without a song.
We have only 100 prizes. Sinatra, it is. Yeah. All right. We'll try the next one, please.
Without a song, the day would never end. Without a song, the road would never bend. When things go wrong, a man ain't got a friend without a song. That field of corn would never see a plow. That field of corn would be deserted now. A man is born, but he's no good no how without a soul.
Right. Billy Eckstein it is. There's only one more. Please. Diana Ross it is. That's a surprising one. All right. Now to continue with a prepared text, very briefly, I'd like to add a postscript to what you've just heard. 3 weeks ago in Hollywood, Bob Dylan was presented by ASCAP with the Founders Award, the purpose of which is to salute the leaders of trends which affect and change the course of popular music. The only other recipient of this award, Stevie Wonder, was honored in 1984. In accepting, Dylan said, and I quote from the Los Angeles Times, he then quoted the lines from a 1929 song that one of his heroes, Elvis Presley, cited in accepting an award. And the words that Bob Dylan spoke were, without a song, the day would never end, and so forth. In preparing notes for the presentation of the Founders Award, an ASCAP staff member discovered that there have been 2,500 cover versions of Dylan's songs. That is, 2,500 recordings of Dylan numbers by other artists. In the 60s, millions of rock fans hailed Dylan for breaking the mold of the popular song. But the tunes, or I should say that not only the tunes, the times they are a-changing. This award and Dylan's own remarks helped cement relation between the old style and the new. Asked whether music today was as meaningful as it was in the 60s, he replied, not really. Pressed to explain, he said, people are going to get sick of it. The Beatles burst on the scene as youth was protesting everything it considered phony. The Vietnam War, the draft, the corporate rat race, and sexual taboos. Woodstock, a musical notion, appeared to some to be the harbinger of a rebellious nation. The demand arose for censorship of the songs, and who should be the leader of the crusade for moral purity? Spiro Agnew. His alliterative denunciations of rock music and the drug counterculture not only raised the hackles of hippie hunters, it also raised campaign contributions from his well-fed followers. It didn't seem to matter that the pro-drug slanted, esoterically phrased songs like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds were on the wane, and that anti-drug songs like Teach Your Children were climbing to the top of the charts. The overwrought Puritan crusaders besieged the FCC. The FCC ordered broadcasters to examine, judge, and bar lyrics, while strongly denying that this was censorship and disclaiming that they were threatening broadcasters. The FCC instructions stated that failure to exercise the prescribed controls, quote, of the use of language tending to promote or glorify the use of illegal drugs, raises some serious questions as to whether continued operation of the station is in the public interest. One member of the FCC, Nicholas Johnson, dissented from his colleague, stating, quote, there is a serious question whether the majority is, in fact, really as concerned about the drug abuse as it is in striking out blindly at a form of music which is symbolic of a culture the majority fears, in part because it totally fails to comprehend it. I do not think it is a business of the FCC to be discouraging or banning song lyrics. End quote. In complete agreement with Nicholas Johnson on this issue, at the American Writers' Congress in 1971, I said, quote, "In this country, people will continue to express their views to be recorded and aired if the present administration disapproves of youth that is influenced by Wilhelm Reich and Charles Reich. The problem will not be solved by instituting a Third Reich." Administrations change, some marching one step forward and some two steps back. But this is a democracy still, with communication constantly growing, and we in this hall can be glad that songs do not have to be murmured to a few, but that a Bruce Springsteen is afforded the means to communicate with millions, articulating not merely their doubts about the present, but their hopes for the future. Thank you. Yeah. You see, I ended with that gesture of protesting against
I feel as though I shouldn't put this back on in that case. Well, let's have some questions from you. Jack Raymond, is addressing your question to whom?
To Mr. Ellis Q. I wonder if you happen to remember the circumstances under which the Carioca was issued by Victor at the time of the movie as what must be one of the very first soundtrack recordings played by the Paramount Studio Orchestra.
No, I'm sorry, I have no knowledge of that. I wish I could help you, but I can't.
Lane?
I have a question to ask. Yes or no, were you part of the Ellis Q trio that made records for Brunswick?
Would you mind repeating that?
There is a Brunswick recording group, studying classical, Ellis Q Trio, Ellis Q, with a S-H in it, that made records for Brunswick back in the 20s. When you mentioned Chell, that excited my information machine upstairs in my head.
You say there was an Ellis Q Trio?
That's right. Ellis Q, it was a little different.
It was spelled a little differently from the way you spell the name. But was it you?
They played McDowell and Kamroski.
I can only advance a quick theory. Someone couldn't spell Elisha. E-L-I-S-H-A. I really don't know. I don't know what it was.
Okay, thank you.
Did the song do well?
It's easy to tell this is a nest of record collectors. Two questions so far.
When you mentioned you played cello, that's what activated this memory of mine.
Yes. Yes, sir.
I would like to know from any or all of the three of you if there was a particular singer who was performing your pop tunes who might not have recorded but that you were particularly fond of.
Well, I can answer that first. Bell Baker, who introduced all of me and made it a hit, never recorded. He wasn't asked.
Well, I remember when I first heard Bing Crosby that he became my idol. And when I first heard Sinatra, I thought, oh no, he can't possibly be in the same league with Crosby. But the years went by and I changed my mind. Crosby was my first idol, and Sinatra was, I suppose, second, and then became first, and they both recorded the Summerland song.
I remember a song that was recorded, and I have the only copy of it. The CIO wanted a song for an organizing campaign for recruiting members. And at that time, working in Meet People review that I was associated with, there was a young singer with a tremendous voice. His name was George Burnson. And we took him to a recording studio, and he sang, recorded this song called Sing Out the Answer, Join the CIO. And the reason I tell this story and cherish the record is that boy, who was then known as George Burnson, 15 years later, was George London of the Metropolitan. I will not sell the record.
You had your hand up, sir. Yes.
Sorry, Mr. Morris, if it's okay, what year did Miss Baker introduce?
Oh, Jerry. I can't tell you about, but I can tell you exactly. I wrote it. Is that what you want to know?
Yes, sir.
1931.
Wait
a minute. Thank you. Where were you then?
Yes, sir.
Dan, yeah. I know that that Shermer album, in those two 12-inch records, were cut in 1940. Is there any possibility that you could circumscribe the recording date somewhat closer? Do you have any a written notation, perhaps, as to actually when that session was cut? I know it was in calendar year 1940, in the first half of the year. Can you circumscribe that to any greater extent?
I think it was warm weather. I don't think it was the middle of winter. My impression was that it was early summer, perhaps. Not the first half of the year, but the later.
It can't be. It was already listed in the Who Is Who of Music, which has a sort of a combined record listing of the output of all the companies, and that listing goes up to, I believe, somewhere around July 18th or July 11th, I just don't recall that. And that album is already listed there. So there had to be time, you know, for the processing of the record and so forth. Obviously, Sherman didn't press its own records. So it had to be somewhat earlier. I believe the highest album number is number 11, and this album is number 8. So it had to have been perhaps slightly earlier than that.
Well, it could have been early spring.
When you and Casper Reardon went across the street for something to eat, what did you have?
Yeah. I understand, you know, back in, I don't know what time, but at one point songs were plugged. Sheet music was plugged, and I gather that sheet, most people did play piano, and heard songs and took them home, and a lot of songs were popularized in that way. How do you feel the change of that to, you know, basically a song being communicated through recordings affected the songwriter?
Are you talking to me?
The entire time. Talk a little about the days of song plugging, if you will.
Well, that era of song plugging died when radio came in, and at that time the songwriter thought that he was finished, because ASCAP was not taking in much money to make up for the death of sheet music. So it was a depression for a little while for the songwriters, until ASCAP started licensing then the songwriter forgot all about sheet music, and those who wrote hits were very well satisfied with the way they were being paid. Does that answer your question?
In part. I'm just interested in hearing about those days and what sheet, you know, how you feel about sheet music as a way of communicating your song as opposed to recordings.
Well, I tell you, I think most of the songwriters have forgotten. Would you say, Eddie? Most songwriters have forgotten about sheet music. On the royalty statements, they don't account for very much today. Maybe here and there may be some sales, but even a song like All of Me, the sheet music sale, sometimes I don't even look at it on the royalty statement. A few thousand, maybe, and that's it. But the ASCAP counterbalanced that in a very good way. And I don't know of a songwriter in the last 25, 30 years who has any complaint about the fact that he's lost out on sheet music. He's after performances today. And that's what he's looking for. And I don't think the fact that a lot of songs aren't even published today. They aren't printed. And I don't think anybody sheds any tears over it.
Well, Daryl is right. I remember that in the Depression years, when radio started to make such inroads on sheet music sales, a hit song, so-called, in terms of sheet music sales, was something like 100 or 150,000 copies. That was a big hit. Prior to radio, the standard was not 200,000, but several million copies. That was a big difference. As Daryl says, it was radio that put the big dent in sheet music sales. And therefore, the need for song covers became less and less. And I remember there was a little song that I wrote called Ho Hum, which was a quickie hit because it lasted about, I mean, the height of its popularity was about 2 or 3 months. And it was a real quickie hit. It sold 5,000 copies a day for about a month when it got started. And that was considered a big, big hit. Of course, nowadays it wouldn't sell 5 copies.
May I say a word?
Oh, sure.
I was speaking with Harry Warren once, several years ago, and he had a song that was number one at the time on radio, and anybody who heard the song would certainly believe that it sold in the millions. And Harry whispered in my ear that it sold 15,000 copies, and it was the biggest song in the country.
There's also the fact, by the way, that I can add from my limited experience that the shop selling published music of any kind is disappearing. Question? Yes, sir.
Yeah, to Mr. Disco especially, but all of you too, many of your songs are very popular.
I had an interesting experience with a song that then became very popular. It was called Columbella, and was written for as a kind of theme song for a Broadway play, a straight play, that was produced by my first cousin, Courtney Burr. And the play was laid in somewhere in Italy, off the shores of Italy, concerned with a comedy about some of our boys in the fleet, and the story of the naval activities and family. And I was to write a typical Italian song to be played offstage, just sort of set the atmosphere. So I chose the title, Golden Bell, because I thought that was easily understood both the English-speaking people and Europeans, which was meant. It was a little dull, was the translation. And later on, I discovered it was published in Europe, and it was taken for an Italian song, a true Italian song, by the Frank Sinatra of Germany, who made a record of it. And never believed that, well, it didn't come from Italy, but that was simply the style of the song. It was rather amusing to me that he recorded it because it was an Italian song.
I've heard many of my songs in foreign countries, even down in Africa, in different languages, in Germany, in France. I forget where. Japanese, who pronounced the Dixie, DC, and I don't think had any idea where it was. but I get a thrill out of it. I get a thrill out of hearing it in a foreign language, in Spanish or Portuguese or any one at all. I do remember, I'm trying to think of a title of a song of mine. I cannot remember it, but the melody that I wrote seemed to be Romanian. And so I can't remember the title of the song, but I put on the copy by Gregor Marcu. And so help me, it passed as an authentic Romanian melody.
Sir.
If I might make a comment, earlier this week we talked about oral history. Can I say this is a supreme example of oral history? All three of you will be remembered not only for your songs now, but for the added dimension you have given us about yourself. You talked about posterity, your songs will be remembered. I think they would be grateful to know and hear something of the man who made it all possible.
Well.
I'll take one more from Morgan, because his hand was up, but that seems to be such an excellent way to
yes.
let these very hard people, and an excellent note on which to end this, but since you can have yours, Morgan.
Okay. Could each of you tell us a little bit about your compositional process? A pop tune is a very short thing, it's not like Bruckner's Fourth. Is it something that comes upon you very quickly, or is it something you laboriously hammer into shape note by note, or are there all varieties?
Who wants to answer that? That's awful.
The old structure of popular songs, which doesn't exist anymore today, you have 32 bars in which to express a musical idea, also a lyric idea. This was a very compact means of expression, and I still think one of the best. And the 32 bars could be a series of 2/8 bars that were repetitious of each other, plus that's 16, and then plus a so-called middle, which was another 8 bars, 24. And then the last 8 bars was a reversion to the first 2/8 bars. This enabled the public to remember a song. You could go out, if it was a good song, a good melody, you could go out of the theater whistling it after hearing it twice. Of course, this doesn't exist anymore today, and I think it's very unfortunate that it doesn't. But this is a craft that you learn. There was another form, also 32 bars, but it was in 2 sections, 16 bars, and then a repetition with maybe a slight variation of the first 16. And it seemed to work very, very well. As a matter of fact, some people say that the sonata form, which Beethoven, I believe, more or less invented, it's still the best new way to present a musical idea in a serious sense.
I don't think there's any particular way in which a song is written. I could not explain to anybody, I don't think, how a song is written, but Dana is absolutely correct. And when she says that repetition was and is a very important part of songwriting, and the songwriters did not invent this. You can go back to operas and listen to this. Here's a fella, I forget who wrote this, here's a fella who knew how to write a popular song, but he wrote it in an opera. Da 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 da. Okay, once, right? He says they haven't got it. Twice. He says those will never be able to get it even with twice. And he knows about simplicity too. So his bridge now is this. Da 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 dee da 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 da. All right, now he's going to give you the release, what we call the release of his tune. Da 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 da. This is repetition. Da 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 dum. Da 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 dum. Da 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 dum. Da 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 dee da 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 da. He says those dopes.
They were actually writing pop tunes.
Absolutely.
And there's a story about the opening line of Verdi, which you may or may not have heard. It's an old story. Verdi, when he wrote Aida, he would not let anybody hear that melody until opening night, because he was so sure that it was going to be a hit. Even the orchestra, the parts were not put up in front of him, because it was so simple anyway. They didn't know the song, because even he knew that if they did know it beforehand, somebody would probably steal it. So he kept it absolutely under wraps until the opening night, and of course, immediately, everybody started singing.
There are hundreds of thousands of unmarked graves around the world of opera composers who didn't have the talent or were not able to write a simple little tune that a child could remember. How simple can you get? My baby, those unmarked graves, I repeat, they house opera composers who couldn't write a simple little ditty.
That's because God did not give them the gift of melody. And when you have that gift, that you cannot take any credit for. All you can take credit for is to develop it, to cherish it, and to share it with others.
I would like to say in closing that you ought to catch Gerald Marks with a piano or something. And you missed a great treat if you didn't hear Dana Squeeze at the piano.
May I thank all of you for all of us. Very much.
Great stress for singers waiting around while a conductor rehearsed the orchestra, if it's a conductor who wasn't familiar with the orchestra and the chorus. Do you remember Maestro Ponca, the chorus director there?
I sure do.
He conducted the chorus like a prize fighter. For a pianissimo, he'd go that way, and this little sound would come out. For a fortissimo, he'd almost have a stroke. What I was going to say is, when we finally moved to RC Italiano, and we had the pick of freelance Italian musicians, then you had to wait an hour while the conductor rehearsed the orchestra for that segment of music to be recorded that day.
Sometime between, you know, you would sing your heart out and then you would cool off waiting for them to rehearse the next act or something. That was nice.
And also some of the conductors, excuse the expression, were so concerned with their performance and sound of the orchestra, they forgot about the singers. That's what bothered me. It's a human failing. It's a conductor's failing.
With the best of them. Yes. Well, now, good point there. Now, without mentioning names, did any of you ever have a conductor that you were ready to assassinate?
I did.
Oh, no, I did.
Please go first. Tell us why. Without names.
I dare be dead.
No, but don't mention.
It was or dies with death. I did a recording with this gentleman of Samson and Delilah. And after the recording,
oh no, it's not the one you think. I did several.
But anyway, with this man, and he's a very famous conductor, an ego the likes of which one cannot elaborate more about.
Starts with the letter S. No, I'm not saying.
At any rate,
lots of conductors start with the name S.
And I was very pleased because I heard it in the studio. I went purposely to the studio to hear it, and I said, "Oh, that's really a yes." And you were not involved.
No, that was for
another company. And I said, that's it. That's that excitement. I like it. It's good. The balance is fabulous. And I okay it. I go home. Didn't give a second thought. About 10 days, 2 weeks later, I get the recording. It's not what I heard in the studio. So I called up the studio and I said, "This is not what I okayed. What did you do with the recording?" So they said, "Oh, well, Miss Stevens, your conductor, came in and he reshuffled the sound of this recording. And then he okayed it."
Well,
orchestra concert with vocal accompaniment, right?
Yeah.
I had a conductor, but his first name started with S also. Not the same guy. It's another S. Yeah. This one has four letters in it. Oh, no, that would start with another letter. No. Anyway, they're so concerned with the sound of the orchestra that sometimes they forget that you know, we're selling the album. It's the singers that are really selling the album, not the orchestra. Oh, it's very important. We can't do it with a harmonica background. It's true. And anyway, I did a marvelous take of Cortigiani one day in the recording of Rigoletto. Dick was there, too. He he was behind that glass, turning, helping people turn the knobs and guiding us and telling one more take, another take, and try. Anyway, I hated him too sometimes. You know, I hated Dick more sometimes. Anyway, I did this wonderful take, and I was because it's a very difficult aria, and I was happy, went home. Was having a little drink with some friends and telling them how happy I felt with this wonderful aria. About 15 minutes later, phone rings, and this conductor with name starts with S says, excuse me, Robert, do you mind to come tomorrow morning? Morning now, I've been. And re-record that because the cello player in the orchestra was not the first cellist. He was a substitute cellist. So would you mind coming back and re-recording the aria? Now, here's a man that was concerned about one of the cellists in the orchestra, not the fact that I did it. So that can happen, you see. And
was he the conductor, whose name we're not mentioning? Was he thinking about the second half of the aria where there is the cello obbligato?
Had to be somewhere with the cello. I don't know where the cello was. When I sing an aria, I have no idea where the cello is.
That recording, Robert, was when, at the end of the kidnapping scene,
yeah.
Oh, that's the
Robert. That was when we were going through that passing phase of having a stage manager moving singers around on this charted pad, and thank the Lord that didn't last too long.
Yes, I too think.
And so Robert was rushing off into the wings, shouting, "Gilda,
Gilda, Gilda, mia Gilda!" And I came in wrong.
And the next thing we hear on the tape is, "Gilda, Gilda, where are you? Your mother wants you."
You know, if you'd have kept that on the recording, we'd have sold a hell of a lot of records.
So many.
Oh, dear.
Let's get away from that subject for a minute. You, unless, Anna, you have a conductor you'd like to bury.
Not really.
Not really.
I can't top Bob. I can be equal, but I can't top
him. I see. All right. You know, in recent years, it's been in the last year or so, there's been a lot of brouhaha and excitement over operatic artists are all of a sudden discovered as crossover artists who are recording pop tunes. You know, and everybody has written about this as though it's the second coming. And
that's funny, though, because we were doing it a long time ago.
40 years.
That's right.
All of you have done this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We did it together.
Bob has done it.
I did it. Several.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Bob. Had her show. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how difficult is it for an opera singer successfully to sing to sell pop songs so that anyone listening to it doesn't think, oh my God, there's an opera singer trying to sing pop?
I think they have to approach it as the media it is. In other words, if you approach a pop tune like an opera singer, probably in my case, in a very high range, of course I would sound very, very operatic. I, for example, always did popular stuff in a much lower area, so I don't like to use the word croon, but yes. But I was more concerned with the style of the piece than I was with my own voice. I mean, as an operatic voice.
But do you have to use a different vocal production for that entirely?
Not really. You just have to, not only scaling down, in my case, I don't know what two of you think, I just thought of having a less vibrating tone, a more fixed note, but certainly always produced as well as I could and supported. No belting, if I could help it.
In my case, I recorded and sang pop songs and show tunes before I even sang opera. I made a living singing pop songs and show tunes before I even sang opera. So it wasn't foreign to me when I finally recorded it or went into opera and went back to pop songs. I was never concerned with the voice when I sang pop songs. I was, the importance was the lyric. I didn't think vocally or technique. I didn't change the style of singing, the technique of singing. I sang the way I always sang, but I was conscious of the lyric, like Frank Sinatra,
yes,
and people. And I listened to many of the recordings of Frank and people like that. And if you do that and concern yourself with what you're singing about, it works.
I don't want to offend you, Bob, in any way, but I would, Reza, I don't know if you think this, I think it is much easier for a man to do a crossover with a pop tune than it is for a woman, successfully.
Why?
Just because a man uses can use his, I hate to say, regular operatic style in a pop tune, his voice. I don't know if it's because it involves chest voice. I think a woman has to be is much more easily discerned as an opera singer if she's not careful.
Recently I made an album. I don't think so.
I used an entirely different kind of singing when I did pop tunes. You know that?
Yeah. Right. Well, Dorothy Kirsten did too, I think. She changed her style entirely. Yes. And her production.
Yes. I mean, I did not sing pop tunes like I sing an aria. Not ever. But also I think, and I again have to then talk about Bob, because I too grew up singing popular songs to begin with, and when I was a youngster. I mean, that's what we used to do. I got 10 years old, from 10 to 14, on the children's aisle, that's what we used to do. We didn't think twice about it. And I don't know, and it was a different kind of singing, and I think you don't forget that. You don't, it's sort of part of it.
It's more primitive. You know.
Primitive.
Yes, more straightforward.
It is.
It's less sophisticated.
And it's less difficult.
I suppose, because it just comes naturally, before you start having to worry about.
And you don't have to worry about high notes, you don't have to worry about it. And like Bob says, the voice is very important, and what you say then, it's so easy with a pop song to say something very beautiful.
Mm. Well, I can see Anna's point too, though, about a man might having less difficulty, especially if he chooses the right pop song, because in my experience, the great pop artists are those who don't have big voices, you know, and the microphone, which is always attached to them, they can whisper into that and create all sorts of magical effects. Sinatra, even in his prime, never had a big voice, but I mean, he is one of the world's great artists. Mm-hmm. And even today, when the voice isn't what it used to be, he still can create magic doing that. But a man, if you have a big voice the way you have, I would think it's awfully difficult to scale down.
No, not at all.
But I don't think you have to scale down. I don't think that's...
I never scaled down
at all. I don't think
all.
That's the approach, to scaling down.
One of the biggest songs, one of the biggest recordings that ever sold for me, I mean, sold more than any aria, everything, was the Whiffenpoof song. It sold almost 1 million copies. And when I recorded it, we broadcast that on my show, and then we went to a studio and recorded. I didn't think I was an opera singer. I was thinking of Crosby. I mean, I did "We're Poor Little Lambs Who Have Lost Our Way." I didn't think resonance. "We're poor little," you know. I say "We're poor little lambs," and if I said "We're poor little lambs who have lost our way," I wouldn't have sold one record. So it's. I think it's a feel.
Yeah.
I think you have to have a feel for
it. Do you think when you were young and long before you ever thought of becoming stars of the opera, did any of you ever play a musical instrument?
Oh, I did. I played two.
What?
I played piano. I still play piano and viola.
She's the big musician.
Yeah.
Why did you choose viola?
I didn't. They chose me for the orchestra, and you need a lot of strength, and I was a basketball and a hockey player, and they thought I had the strongest shoulder to carry a big violin, as it were. So they really convinced me to start taking lessons, and I did, and before you know it, I was in the orchestra.
The reason is because just accidentally not long ago I discovered, and I don't know if this is true, but somebody sent in a Xerox of a clipping from a, I think, 1909 newspaper from Redondo Beach, California, a review of a concert by the Redondo Beach Band, showing a picture of Madame Ernestine Schumann Heink playing the trumpet. And, you know, the review was very favorable. In a way, something crazy. And I had never heard that about Schumann Heink. I've talked to a lot of people about it, and they say it cannot be true. You know, her autobiography, everything ever written about her, never mentions her being a trumpet player.
I don't know.
I think it should. I think it makes her very simpatica. One of the boys. I think that's great.
Well, she had the lungs for it.
had everything else.
But did you know that Benjamino Gigli played the saxophone?
No.
Oh.
Are you sure?
I've got a picture of him doing it.
Was a joke. Really, did he? The saxophone?
Gigli.
He kept it well hidden. That
fact. He played saxophone.
Saxophone, yes.
I played a hell of a harmonica, I'll tell you that.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, now, let's get back to opera.
Why? No, I'm kidding. I'd like to.
This is a stupid question, which I always like to ask singers. You know, is there one role in your career that you wish you had sung and you never did?
Oh, yes. Two roles I would have loved to have sung. Tosca.
Well.
And Eva in Meistersing.
And you were a mezzo and out of that league. Why would you want to sing Eva?
I don't know. Everyone asks me that. I think.
She's almost as dumb as Elsa.
I don't know. But I would have made her not so dumb.
Anything would have been an improvement.
No, I think perhaps I had such an awe of Lotte Lehmann when I was a youngster. And I was in Salzburg as a student. And she was Eva at that time. And I'll never forget, I was in that performance, and either it was Toscanini or Bruno Walter, one of the two that was singing. I think it was Toscanini. And she was up there with Shore. And it was an incredible cast. And there I sat as a student way up on the top. And she was so exquisite. And the way she did it, and her kind of parlando that she had, and that manner that she had. And I said to myself, my God, that's what I love. And I looked at the score and I was saying, I knew that.
Yeah.
One time, look, I'll go, but before you get to the other, I'll go and tell you that a very famous, even this happened with Lotte, a very famous conductor, he shall be nameless.
Starts with S.
No, it doesn't start with an S.
Okay.
We're in his studio. No, but. Lotte Lehmann had the one time come to her ranch, her home and ranch, mm-hmm. The cool company something in Santa Barbara. And I went there, and Bruno Walter was there. And she said, oh, Lisa, I had such a surprise for you. I couldn't imagine. And he was like saying, you know, you come to visit me. And she, of course, to me, she was the queen. So I'm not sure I did. And Walter was with him, my husband. And we went. And we sat and we had lunch outside her place, and there was Bruno Walter and his wife and Thomas Mann. Mm. You know, and we sat around, we talked, and I couldn't imagine what this was all about. And she called me inside to her room, and Meister was at the piano. And I said, what are you asking me to do? Why can't I call you? She said, Beistro wants you to be his next Fidelio.
Up, Charlotte.
I said, Fidelio? Oh, I had a great son of Fidelio. Oh, she said, don't worry. He has said he'll tutti it. Whatever it is, you can't say.
Mark it down. For Beethoven, Bruno Walter was going to do that.
And I said, a critic will kill me. And I cannot take that chance, and I will not take that chance.
You were wise.
And he was at the piano, and he was so angry with me. He was really angry with me. And,